Good afternoon, and welcome to Spokane Public Radio's Northwest Arts Review, a half hour exploring the people, places, and events forming the rich arts tapestry we enjoy here in the Inland Northwest and our wider Intermountain Northwest region. I'm Jim Tevenin, pleased to be your guide on this journey. Today, our music on the way in provides a kind of preview of our first feature, an update from Spokane Symphony Orchestra music director James Lowe. It's the third movement of the Trout Quintet by Franz Schubert from one of the Symphony Soiree programs given earlier this season and encored on last Monday's Concert of the Week. The venue for the concert was the Fox Theater, with audience joining the players on stage, making for a grand but intimate experience. Presenting the concerts there was an experiment, an example of the kind of innovative thinking and practice so necessary in all aspects of the arts today. And that thinking was definitely on display in my wide-ranging conversation with James Lowe that opens this edition of Northwest Arts Review. A few things to talk about today, and one of them certainly is an effort that the symphony is making to support its musicians through, you know, you can have all these wonderful programs, but those who actually make it happen on the ground, the musicians are in rather a difficult position at this point. So tell us a little bit about the efforts of the symphony to support the players.
Well, of course, like all arts institutions, we rely on performing income to support us. That's how our business model works. And of course, as soon as you are not performing, you're not making any money. Unfortunately, we've had to be in the position of furloughing pretty much everybody in the orchestra, management and players included. Even with the new CARES Act, because of the way the kind of complicated contracts work for some of our musicians, some of them may well fall through those cracks. So we set up this emergency relief fund for the musicians, where essentially it's a fund that will cover people for their more pressing immediate needs. So for example, right now, the unemployment system is overloaded. So a lot of our people can't get through. So if they have a rent check due or if they have to pay some bills, we're able to support them in doing that.
Those of us who are still going to work every day are feeling it in an entirely different way than certainly those who are part of what is rather inelegantly called the gig economy, which covers so many people these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, musicians, we have always been the original gig economy workers. For most of us, that's just how we live. But in a moment like this, as I say, as soon as you're off stage, then you're in trouble.
You've been very busy and embarking on new parts of your career that you probably never dreamed that you would be involved with, to the production of videos and all kinds of marvelously creative things. Tell us a little bit about how that's been going.
Well, personally for me, I've been creating a new podcast series, which we're two episodes in, first with Mateusz Wolski, the second with Chris Cook. I'm also doing a weekly playlist of some of my favorite music. I started out as music for calm, and it's evolved into just incredibly beautiful music. So it's some of my favorite beautiful moments of many, many different pieces and a range of genres as well. It's not just symphonic music. And our musicians, of course, are doing a huge amount online. They're doing these home performances, which are going on our Facebook page. And we're trying very, very hard to stay connected with our community, because music and musicians, our job is to bring people together. And of course, that's very, very hard to do when everybody is sat at home in their own living room. So we're trying to find ways to continue to connect to our public so that we're still present in their lives and we can bring them a bit of a smile and connect them to something bigger than themselves. If you go to the Facebook page that has all the videos that the musicians have done, if you go to Spotify, you can find the podcast. And the usual places you can dig out podcasts is pretty much on most of those. Our website is a repository for what's going on, so check that out. But Facebook is pretty much the best way to see these videos live, and also I think they're all archived there too.
Now, you have become a music programmer not only for symphony orchestras, but also for the Spotify effort that you're putting forward. We could have a job for you maybe here in public radio. You never know where these things lead. But are there any pieces that you have been able to revisit in this whole process where you think to yourself, oh my, why has it been so long since I've heard this piece? Any specific examples of that?
I can absolutely give you specific examples. I presume you asked that question because you have that a lot in your job, but I've certainly discovered it. I was listening recently to Elgar One because I've been trying to find some of my most favorite slow movements. And Elgar First Symphony is a piece I haven't listened to in a long time. And I put the slow movement on and suddenly thought, my goodness me, why haven't I programmed this? Almost all the pieces on this playlist, most of them are not coming up in the new season. And I keep listening to this and adding it to my very, very long list of pieces that I wish to program.
Mm-hmm. If only there were a 50-week season to the symphony, then all of this would be a possibility. And speaking of the symphony and of better times ahead, we hope, I assume that you, in the midst of your production duties, you find time to do some score study for what's coming up. So are there any pieces that are particularly demanding your attention right about now?
Well, Mahler 2, of course, is a huge monster of a piece. And that's something that, you know, I was actually prepared to conduct, I think it's this coming week. But still, you can't ever study that too much. In fact, I would say you can't ever study any piece too much. So there's that. The Rite of Spring is coming, of course, at the end of the season. That's always a challenge for a conductor. I say it's a little bit like some extreme sport like bungee jumping. It's terrifying while you do it, but the thrill and the adrenaline when you survive it is quite cool. So it's nice. Actually, it is a nice moment to look a little bit ahead and get on top of that score study cycle. I mean, as a conductor, you have a constant timetable of homework coming up, and you've got to be pretty consistent and disciplined about getting the notes into your skull. So it's quite nice actually right now to have a bigger gap than I had planned for.
Although you do have a new presence in your life, which is, I'm sure, demanding much attention. His name is Humphrey, which is just a wonderful name for your puppy. And does he show any musical promise yet?
Well, so Humph is, he's a terrier mix. He's 3 months old from 2 days ago. The only time he barks is when I play the violin. So whether he's being critical or he's trying to join in, it's very strange. He runs into the room when I'm playing, sits right in front of me, runs around in circles, barks and yaps, but stays in the room and keeps doing that. So as I say, maybe he's a latent music critic, or maybe he's just trying to sing along, but that's the only time he ever barks.
Are there any other innovative projects that you have thought up along the way, or you and symphony staff have thought up along the way, in terms of keeping the profile of the symphony and its players and its mission in front of the public eye?
Well, a lot of the things we've done have been those things which are almost all new for us. I have to say, this is a time when we don't really know what the future holds for the entire planet at the moment. So I've long felt that the model of the symphony orchestra that kind of came from the 1950s, which is to say it's a machine for generating concerts, I've long felt that that has become a little bit outmoded is the wrong word, but it's become a little bit not keeping up with the times. Now, that's not to say I don't think symphony orchestras should play concerts in concert halls. Of course they should. That's the bread and butter. But I'm really interested in how can symphonies connect with the community? What work can we do out in the community? We were planning a dementia project for next season, which now, like everything, is on hiatus. But it's incredible how you can use music to help with medical intervention. So, for example, I mean, with this dementia project, you can have real conversations with people who are pretty much locked into their own world. Not verbal conversations, but musical conversations, improvised. And you can really bring people out. So things like that, using music as a tool and not just as an entertainment product, I think is a rich vein that all orchestras must be mining in the future. And I suspect that the crisis we're going through now is actually going to be a catalyst for re-examining how a symphony orchestra works and how it fits into its community.
It's an amazing thing, and I guess on one level a sad thing, that sometimes real innovation only comes out of desperation and comes out of situations that they're the last place we want to be, but here we are, and some really very creative and ultimately wonderful things can come out of that.
I'm just reading a book at the moment called Anti-Fragile, which is about this very thing, which is the idea that there's resilience, which is to say you can survive a bad event. But if you're anti-fragile, you actually are made stronger by it. You adapt and you change. Mm-hmm. And I think I am always a wide-eyed optimist. And so I like to think that this is giving us an opportunity to examine assumptions that we've made for a long time and see if there are maybe not better ways of doing things. Honestly, I don't know. Nobody knows right now, but it seems to me there's always opportunity in every crisis. And I think we will see a sudden resurgence of live music when we get back to it, because I think people now are realizing how much they miss it, and that sitting at home watching TV and Netflix and listening to stuff online actually not at all as good as the real thing.
More information about James Lowe and the Spokane Symphony Orchestra is at spokanesymphony.org. And as James mentioned, podcasts and performance videos are available on the orchestra's Facebook page. The Wild Goose blends classic film noir with the heartbeat of modern China, says Dan Webster in this review.
Every country has its dark side. Cinema tells us that much. Just consider the many Law and Order sagas that are possible to watch through a variety of streaming sources, whether they involved Italian mobsters, Danish serial killers, Mexican drug lords, or the worst of U.S. corporate criminals. Wait, sorry about including that last group. I was confusing the movies I've been watching with the headlines taken from daily news reports. But getting back to movies, one of the best films that I saw in 2019 was Jia Zhangqiu's Ashes the Purest White, which is the tale of a low-level gangster and the woman he wrongs, all set against the backdrop of a China that is changing faster than you can say cultural revolution. I was reminded of Zha's film this past week as I watched The Wild Goose Lake, a film movement feature that I streamed through the Magic Lantern Theater. Written and directed by Diao Yinan, The Wild Goose Lake has a noir plot that should feel recognizable to anyone familiar with the works of Fritz Lang, Nicholas Ray, or Sam Fuller. It involves a gangster just released from prison who tries to step back into his old life, yet, as is typically the case, he finds himself being challenged by younger guys with more ambition than brains. The result is a violent clash that ends up embroiling the police and which sets our protagonist, a weary guy named Zhao Zenong, against not only the authorities, who offer a hefty reward for his capture, but also his rival mobsters, who look to cash in at his expense. Before he even knows what's happening, Zhao finds himself on the run, wounded and desperate, skulking through the night while trying somehow to connect with his estranged wife. The connection he seeks to make comes through one of the most standard noir plot devices of all, a mysterious woman. In this case, she's not a Barbara Stanwyck or a Lana Turner, but an androgynous so-called bathing beauty, a euphemism for prostitute, whose motives, unsurprisingly, are hard to figure out. If that scenario were all the Wild Goose Lake had to offer, it would still be worth watching. But Diao is interested in more than merely telling the story of a doomed mobster. He may not have Zha's pressing desire to make larger comments about contemporary Chinese culture, especially how its 21st century economy literally is changing the country's very face. The devastation affecting the river communities being flooded by, say, the Three Gorges Dam project is, after all, a central feature of Zha's Ashes the Purest White. But Diao isn't content just to make an engaging story either, no matter how poignant. Some aspects of The Wild Goose Lake actually feel more than a bit confusing, which may or may not be due to the certain plot effects getting lost in translation, but certainly do have to do with the film's tendency to bend chronology in ways that aren't always easy to follow. What Diao attends to most of all is his shot selection. Whether he's filming Zhao standing in the shadows of a train station late on a rainy night, framing Zhao and the mystery woman together in a way that feels like something dreamed up by the Italian master Michelangelo Antonioni, or staging an ongoing shootout with an ever-increasing feeling of futility, Diao matches whatever substance he's attempting to achieve with a clear sense of personal style. Oh, and in terms of substance, give him this much. Like all great purveyors of noir, Diao provides his film's ending with a quality that, though it comes unexpectedly, ends up feeling as natural as Jake Geddes being stung not once, but twice in Roman Polanski's Chinatown. The quality in question? A staple even more intrinsic to noir than darkness itself. Irony. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Dan Webster.
Dan Webster writes about movies and more for Spokane7.com and hosts Spokane Public Radio's Movies 101, now back and heard noon Thursdays on KPBX, as well as at 1 on Saturdays on KSFC. It's also available as a podcast from SpokanePublicRadio.org, where you can now find this program, Northwest Arts Review. We close today with the remembrance of a musician and composer who, while not from our area, has an intimate connection with it. David Keberle, who had a long and flourishing career in both art music and jazz realms, is the brother of prominent Spokane trumpeter and Whitworth University professor Dan Keberle. David died last May. And Dan joined me on the anniversary of his passing to look back on his brother's life and the times David brought his superb clarinet playing to Spokane. Take us back to happier times, to the Keberle household as you were growing up. Was music always a part of what you guys did?
Yes, music was always a part. My father was an amateur violinist. He played principal in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin Youth Symphony and eventually went into law, but he took his violin out every Christmas and would play it for us, and we had a piano and we all took piano lessons, and so there was a lot of music. And of course my parents are of the age, they grew up in the big band era, so they played recordings all the time of that kind of jazz. But not only that, my brother was, he was really, when it comes to music, kind of a real Renaissance man. He dabbled in everything. So I woke up every morning, I could hear him playing the Beatles from his bedroom, you know, for many, many years. And he listened to all kinds of music from other cultures and jazz and vocal music. And so he was a huge influence on my life. And when I was in high school, he would bring recordings home. He went to Indiana University and studied clarinet there and music composition with Bernard Haydn. When I was in high school, every time he'd come home from college, he'd bring me another recording of something. And he would introduce me one time to Stravinsky's Firebird Suite and another time to Bartok's string quartets. And then one time he'd bring a recording of the Buddy Rich Jazz Band, you know, and I grew up, you know, we grew up in this little town in Wisconsin, so we weren't exposed to too much of that, and there was no internet back then, so you had to get the records, and that's what he did. He was a very big influence, and, you know, he formed rock bands and had me playing them with him when we were really young, and so it was the full spectrum of all kinds of music. And I think that's kind of the way he lived his life, his professional life, all the way.
Thank you.
those who are unfamiliar with your brother and his career and his reputation, he was very much a figure in the world of contemporary music. And
Yes. When
I say contemporary music, this is that whole most intriguing period that sort of perhaps peaked in the latter half of the 20th century with all the experimentation with sound and instrumental technique and sounds that clarinet, for example, you never heard the clarinet make those sounds, but all of a sudden that becomes part of the vocabulary of players of the instrument.
Yes, go ahead.
You know, well, I'm just wondering how he gets started, what may have set him on that particular compositional path.
Well, I think, you know, his time at Indiana with Bernard Haydn, he talked to me about this every so often. He was really pushed by his teachers there in composition to try to write music that had never, ever been written before. He didn't want to use anything conventional in terms of chords or melodies or even rhythms. I mean, if you had a chance to look at this music, you'd be amazed at how complicated the rhythms are.
Mm-hmm.
And when you listen to it, it almost sounds like there is no rhythm, but it actually was the opposite. It was extremely detailed rhythm. He wrote a concerto for me once for trumpet and chamber group, and it took me about a year to learn it, and mostly because of all the counting issues. I mean, I've never just seen so many crazy rhythmic things that were very hard to put together with a beat.
Mm-hmm.
And then it wouldn't just be in my part. Everybody would have things like that. So, yeah, he was all about trying to arrange the notes in a sound that had never been done before. And a little story, one time, I think I was still in high school. I didn't know what I was talking about, really. And I said, David, it sounds like your music, like you can just write anything you want. And we're talking about this really modern music mm-hmm. that he wrote. And he said, well, I can't write this. And he'd play a C major triad. And he said, and I can't write this. And he'd play a major scale or something, you know, really familiar. And he was kind of ticked off at me, like, there's a lot of things I can't write because it's all been written. And he wanted to write things that had never been written before.
How much did the world of jazz play in his thinking, and did he get a chance to perform much in that arena?
Well, he always listened to jazz, and he certainly did his share of jazz gigs and with bands and different groups. And but his professional life and his degrees were in modern classical composition and also in the clarinet, classical clarinet. So I don't think he did as much jazz as he would have liked to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he really jumped on the few times we had him, four times with the Spokane Jazz Orchestra as our guest artist. And of course, Benny Goodman was, of course, the number one in the entire world that could play anything, but Benny Goodman played a lot of classical music,
mm-hmm,
as we all know, and in addition to his jazz. So my brother was definitely inspired by that and did a fair amount of jazz. But these concerts he did with SGO were really, really fun for us.
Let's reminisce and go back to another one, actually another one that was led by Gunther Schuller. This is the Moon Glow arrangement.
This is, yeah, for Artie Shaw, yes.
Uh-huh. My whole conversation with Dan Keberle is available as a From the Studio podcast at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Northwest Arts Review. I'm Jim Tevenin. We're grateful for our guests today, James Lowe and Dan Keberle. Likewise, thanks to Dan Webster and our trout fishers, pianist Archie Chen and Spokane Symphony Orchestra members Mateusz Wolski, Nick Carper, Johannes Kleinman, and Patrick McNally. Join us next week for another Northwest Arts Review.